The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This week's The Interview is brought to you by AndrewandTodd.com. AndrewandTodd.com are the world's best lenders for real estate. They are with Sierra Pacific Mortgage. You can call them at 888-1172, 888-1172. And please do, no matter what your lending needs are, AndrewandTodd.com. And now welcome to this new edition of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. General, let's begin. Call sign chaos. Colonel has another outstanding solution. I love that. Colonel Tulin gave that to you. Can you please explain what he was doing and where when you came up with that call sign?
Well, like all good ideas, it came out of California. It was the dry side. We were out in the Mojave Desert, and he was my operations officer then. And I had a lot of good ideas. We had 7,500 sailors and Marines out in the Mojave Desert with nothing to do. So I always came up with good ideas what we're going to do. And one day I saw chaos written on his whiteboard. So I stopped after delivering yet another good idea. And I said, what's a chaos mean? And he said, oh, you don't want to know that. And I said, well, yeah, I do. And so I prevailed since I outranked him. Actually, I waterboarded him, but it wasn't cool enough. And it meant Colonel has another outstanding suggestion here. It was very tongue-in-cheek from my irreverent troops, so I adopted it as my call sign from then on. Kind of keep reminding myself to be a little humble that not all my troops thought I was as smart as I thought I was.
It's a great way to begin. I want to talk to you specifically about four of the passages in call sign chaos that involve combat. You led the jump off into the invasion of Iraq in 1991. You returned for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. In between, you led the invasion of the Marines into Afghanistan, and you led the first battle of Fallujah. So I would like to ask you an anecdote from each of those. The ambush at the quarry occurs because you had learned from Colonel Fulford, your direct report, the casualties were estimated to be 50%. You went home and couldn't sleep that night and came back and told everyone that I want everything dead inside the U, including the earthworms. And therefore, it was a devastating attack on the enemy position when you invaded Iraq. But you got a little overconfident. Would you talk about the ambush at the quarry, what you learned from it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we got through what was supposed to be a very difficult time. We rewrote the fire support plan. And it was very effective. We lost men wounded. We had vehicles knocked out. Fortunately, no one killed. It's the last operation I brought everyone home alive from. But after a couple of days of fighting, it's hard to describe how tired you get in that kind of fighting, especially with night vision goggles and other things. We had some and not many in those days. But for fighting night and day in the smoke. And I got tired. And we went across an open desert. We got squeezed by a quarried area. We looked at it. Flew airplanes over it, nothing in it. And sure enough, we came around the side, tight, not spread out like we could have been because of the terrain. And right then, the whole horizon lit up, and I was just dead tired. We went right underneath the power line. I should have recognized that would be the target reference point. And the whole horizon lit up. And at that moment, my logistics troops in the rear were ambushed by a bunch of mechanized vehicles coming out of the quarry. And so, again, you know when your mortars are being set up to fire both north and south in the middle of an open desert, you've accomplished the impossible. You've gotten your troops surrounded in the middle of an open desert. Not a good time, as usual, when I got my troops in a jam. They got me out of it. But it was a tough time, but I learned, you know, you'd better be careful when you think that from the air they can spot everything. We'd missed it. And at the same time, be alert when you get tired. Get your motivation going again. Don't get sloppy because you can walk even in the open desert, your troops right into a problem. The real lesson I learned that day was We got called over to the regimental headquarters of Task Force Ripper, and Colonel Fulford had us all together, all the lieutenant colonels, and he said, they're killing the innocent people in Kuwait City. We got to go still tonight. It was very dark. It was noontime, or shortly after noon, but the oil smoke was so bad you had to use a flashlight to read a map even at noon. And so we all got our orders, and we turned to go back to our units and get ready to roll. And Colonel Fulford just called me over and said, Jim, you learn anything today? I said, yes, sir. He said, good, and he turned around and walked off. He didn't make a big deal of it. He knew I screwed up, but didn't make a big deal of it. And that lesson stuck with me from then on, that how to deal with it when one of your troops, you know, runs into something like that, because once it's happened to you, you don't look at it quite the same again.
Second instance is when you lead the Marines into Rhino, and it is the longest expeditionary jump, I believe, of the Marine Corps in their history. Can you tell people a little bit about how you came to command Task Force 58 and why it is such an extraordinary accomplishment for the Marine Corps?
Well, I benefited because some Marines back in the 1950s got KC-130 tanker aircraft into our inventory. Some other Marines in the 1970s brought in a CH-53 Echo heavy lift helicopter with a refueling probe on it so it could refuel. And then we got light armored vehicles into the Marine Corps. And, of course, we changed our recruit training to make it much more rigorous in the 1990s. And I was the beneficiary of all this when, after 9/11, I was a one-star, and the fleet commander of 5th Fleet called me in, three-star, Vice Admiral Willie Moore. And Willie's a wild man. If it had been 150 years ago, he'd have had a cutlass in one hand, an eye patch, and a Jolly Roger at the masthead. And Willie said, you know, the Army Special Forces and the CIA are orchestrating the attack up north against the enemy at Mazar-e Sharif. They're going to lose. They'll fall back on Kabul. The admiral had done his homework. He said, Kabul hasn't been held in 500 years. He said, they're going to fall back on Kandahar, their spiritual home. He said, I need you to go after Kandahar. Can you get the Marines from the Mediterranean Fleet and the Pacific Fleet together and land 350 miles inland and, you know, basically move against Kandahar? He put it a little more colorfully, what I was due to Kandahar. And I said, yes, Admiral, I can do it. I go look at it. He said, sure, you just go look at it and tell me what orders I have to send, and we'll do it. But he was an admiral who he could see the enemy was focusing everything up north, and he wanted to put the enemy on the horns of a dilemma. He knew how he could do it with naval forces because of our ships and what they could do and our Marines, and he wanted to extend that naval influence ashore. It was no problem. We could have gone 600 miles, to tell you the truth, ladies and gentlemen. That was the right place to go that we chose. And we went in, and first I went up and I circled around. I'll tell you now how to make four-star general. So you young soldiers and Marines, you take notes now, okay? You know, what you want to do is fight enemy generals dumber than a bucket of rocks, okay? And they'd left the back door open. And I could see, no matter how brave their boys were, how many tanks they had, and they had a bunch of tanks and all this kind of stuff, it didn't matter because their generals were dumb, and we were going to take them in the back, and there wasn't anything much they could do about it. So we put together a team. We went in, and the admiral never gave me any more orders. He just left me alone to do whatever I thought was right, and we were able to go in and do it.
Now, what's interesting about that, and I stopped. I have a very heavily annotated copy of Call Sign Chaos. She became the first Marine in history to command. And when we say in the history of the United States Navy, that's a lot of history. You were the first to command a Navy ship. How much static did your admiral get for that?
Well, he wasn't a man to worry about what other people thought of him, to tell you the truth. But there were 7 ships at times. There was a Canadian ship, HMCS Halifax, would be the destroyer that came in as we went near the coast each night. And the 6 U.S. Navy ships. Actually, I was the second because there was a Marine lieutenant back in 1812, I think, who commanded a prize ship that we'd taken from the British. But he got some heat on it, but he didn't worry about it. It was a good team.
You mentioned the lesson you learned because your Marines were not allowed to go and trap Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora. You faulted yourself for not communicating up. Would you explain that?
Yeah, so we were on the ground, and we were joined as fast as we got there by Allied troops, mostly from NATO, Canada, United Kingdom, Germany, Norway, Jordan, Turkey, Australia, New Zealand. They were with us immediately. I'd go out and they'd say, why are you here? You weren't attacked by these maniacs on 9/11. They said, because we share the same values. Very interesting lesson. Very interesting lesson on leadership about the United States and how much people trusted us that they would come and fight alongside us, knowing by doing so they were going to attract the hatred of the terrorists who had attacked us. Something to remember when we think about NATO and the other countries that rallied to our side. And they've lost many, many of their guys doing it. We took Kandahar Airport. We took over the town, basically. And the Afghan people were overjoyed to see us. But Osama bin Laden, our intelligent people, had spotted, or at least had very good indications, that he was in one of two valleys in a place called Tora Bora. So I'd studied the Geronimo campaign down here along the border, the southwest border, from the late 1800s, and the way the Army put in heliograph stations all along the border within sight of each other. So if Geronimo's band tried to raid into the United States, they could be picked up. I had a computerized visibility diagram done. We picked out the mountaintops. I'm all focused on this. I know how we can block the routes out. And then we're going to move assault troops up the valleys and flush him out. He wouldn't be able to stay there. What I'd failed to do, and the lesson I learned, Hugh, was I'd fallen under Army command and control at that point. I still commanded the ships at sea under the Navy, but the troops ashore after a little while were put under Army command and control. And I had not spent time getting to know their general and explain to him what I was putting together. I assumed too much. And so basically we didn't get the orders to go, and Osama bin Laden got away. And as you all know, he was eventually hunted down by the U.S. intel community, and our SEALs killed him. But we might have had a chance to get him sooner. I considered it to be my failure to keep my seniors, my new chain of command, fully informed that we were ready to do it.
Yeah, there was a lot of frustration on your part, very carefully explained in call sign chaos. There's another inexplicable halt on the march up to Baghdad.
Yeah.
And you describe it in detail. Would you tell the audience what that was and why it was so frustrating to you?
Right. The attack into Iraq in 2003 was one where we assumed the enemy had chemical weapons, and we weren't the only ones who assumed that. The United Nations assumed it. The Israelis assumed it. The Kuwaitis assumed it. There are a whole lot of intel communities that thought that he had those weapons. Why else would he be blocking the UN inspectors? So when we attacked, we were zipped up into chemical protection suits. They're very uncomfortable to fight in. They're difficult to move in. You sweat a lot in them. It's just tough. And we were stopped at this point as we were tacking up a road that is on the direct downwind from Baghdad. In other words, we'd been told as we get close to the Tigris River approaches that we would be hit by chemicals. There was a concern with supply lines. We did not have concerns in the Marines. Every Marine is trained as a rifleman, so if the supply troops, we would bypass some enemy if they weren't a big problem with our assault troops. And if the supply troops had to fight their way by them, that was their problem. They knew how to fight. I wasn't worried about it. This wasn't exactly a tough enemy. So we did not want to stop, because when you stop, the enemy can start getting brave and feeling like they can stop us. So it was very frustrating. I was within probably 24 hours of designating the 5th Regimental Combat Team into the 5th Reconnaissance Combat Team and going on a very strong reconnaissance for the Tigris River at that point. I was trying to come up with an artful way to keep going. But again, I think what we have to watch out for is, in the age of electronics and digital communications, it's easy to think that up above, you know what's going on. Down below, the young sergeants and lieutenants, they knew we could keep going. There was no problem. The logistics troops back in there, they knew they could fight their way by the enemy. But somehow, people got nervous up above and stopped us at the worst possible moment. And eventually, we got going again, but the enemy had had time to adjust. So it was difficult. It was more difficult than it otherwise would have been.
So, General, you did not write this. I want to emphasize this is not in call sign chaos. But a lot of people did write that the delay at Tora Bora and the delay in the march up was because Big Army did not want the Marines to accomplish those missions, that there was inter-service rivalry impacting the chain of command. Do you credit those allegations at all?
Not in the least. I think there were very straightforward reasons why it happened, and I think that is just a bunch of baloney.
All right. The next time you get stopped...
Ladies, if you weren't here, I'd describe it more artfully.
The next time you get stopped, you get started and you don't want to get started in the first battle of Fallujah. You had advised a different set of tactics, which I'd like you to explain. But then you began and you quoted Napoleon. In fact, you made it an R-rated quote. Napoleon famously said, if you're going to take Vienna, take Vienna. In the book, it describes the fact you've got an R-rated version of that. What happened in the first battle of Fallujah?
You know, ladies and gentlemen, we went into Anbar province. It's the Sunni triangle. You've heard the names of Fallujah, Ramadi, and the others. It was the most difficult area in terms of the embedded insurgency. We were relieving the 82nd Airborne Division. They briefed us very well about what was coming up. There was a very good turnover, but within a couple weeks, four contractors wandered into Fallujah without checking in with the Marines in the area. They were killed, burned, bodies strung up, desecrated. And we knew that the city had tribal elements. We had spies in the city. And so what I suggested was, don't get angry. Great nations don't get angry. I'll get the bodies back and get them back to their loved ones, and we'll hunt down. We've got the photos, and we've got people who tell us who did it. We'll hunt them down, and we'll kill them one by one. We'll get them. Out of Washington came orders, despite what my senior, Lieutenant General Conway, wanted to do, which was support me with this much more measured, targeted approach. General Sanchez in Baghdad, the Army general who commanded the overall effort, was in agreement. General Abizaid, the CENTCOM commander, was. But we were told for other reasons we had to make a demonstration here. And so we had to evacuate hundreds of thousands of people. Of course, that meant the enemy could be in amongst them, moving stuff in and out and that sort of thing. And I only had two assault battalions to throw against the city. So it was going to be a heck of a fight because there were more enemy in the city than we had troops to put against it initially. And I said, okay, after 4 days when they ordered me to do it, I'll do it, but don't stop me. And, of course, deep inside the city again, we were stopped, eventually pulled to withdraw. But what was really important, I remember a young light machine gunner. He's a kid from down south, blonde-haired kid, filthy, dirty, with his machine gun over his shoulders. The Marines were pulling back, and a camera got put in his face. And he has asked, isn't this terrible? You know, it's terrible you lost your buddies. Isn't it terrible you have to pull back? Don't you feel terrible? And going on and on. And the young kid doesn't talk real fast. Just turn around, looks in the camera and says, doesn't matter. We'll hunt him down somewhere else and kill him. But what he was really talking about there was he was not losing faith in the chain of command as we'd been ordered in. And then we'd had to go through this hiatus where we weren't attacking, they were attacking us, but little pinpricks, and then we had to pull back. You can imagine how tough that was in the spirits of the young troops. But they didn't lose faith. They didn't lose confidence. That's when loyalty really counts. Loyalty really counts when there's 100 reasons to dredge up to say, I'm not going to be loyal today. They didn't suck the thumb. They didn't go cynical and start saying, you know, cowardly things or go start talking about being a victim or anything like that. They said, we'll hunt them down somewhere else. And they came out, and that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, somewhere in the book you write, morale is evidenced by a lack of self-pity. There was no self-pity in the Marines called to withdraw.
No, I mean, too often I think we see a response to difficult circumstances at times of either cynicism, you know, well, there's nothing you can do about it, or it's this victimhood, I'm a victim. No, you're always making choices. And one thing you can always choose is how you're going to react, and that's what that young Lance Corporal did that day. He chose not to react by sucking his thumb, and that's the kind of people that we send after the enemy these days. I mean, those maniacs who attacked us on 9/11, they really thought they could scare us by hurting us. And this country doesn't scare, and that's one thing that always humbled me among the troops, that when those sergeants or lieutenants pointed to a young troop and pointed toward the enemy, they'd be up and going after them. So we're really, really lucky, those of us who got to serve there. People thank me for my service. I mean, the country's worth it. You know, I was humbled always to be around those guys. And no victimhood, no cynicism. Those are just signs of cowardice.
General, in the decisions that are most memorable for being bad in the Iraq War, one is the decision to disband the Iraqi army, and the other is the decision to stop the first battle of Fallujah, both taken by civilian authorities. Is it, in your opinion, better when you have an occupying force to have a warrior in charge? It worked for MacArthur. It worked for Eisenhower. Didn't work for Lord Mountbatten, who was a warrior, but when India separated from Pakistan, 1 million people were done. If there had been a warrior in charge of the occupation, would it have gone better?
Well, I think what you have to look at is when you're in charge of anything, I don't care if you're running a business, a small business, or you're running a football team, or you're running a military operation, the most important thing is make very clear what is your intent. And your intent is, what is your aim? What are you trying to do? And make it so clear that there can be no doubt about it. In other words, you're identifying the problem you're trying to solve, and then put in, just vaguely, what method you're going to use. I want you to use multiple avenues because this is very channelized terrain. I don't want to have everybody lined up one behind another, so if they block us at one point, they stop. You see what I mean? And then put down the end state. And the end state is where it went wrong. It doesn't matter who's in charge if you don't get the end state right. And if we don't get the end state right, then you're in an inconclusive war that just grinds on and on. You don't have people focused. If you get it right, and we got it right tactically, we got it right operationally, you saw how fast the statue in Baghdad came down. You saw what happened there. But strategically, we missed the mark. And that can have calamity written all over it if you don't get that part right. And that's where we fail. And that's where we've got to get better at it. And that means we've got to have people who study history and are informed but can still think like an 18-year-old sailor, soldier, marine down at the very bottom who's got to make it happen and make it so clear they know what they're doing.
Was the civil war in Iraq inevitable?
Well, when you take the person off, the oppressor off the top that's oppressing and keeping those people down, history will tell you those passions will come out. We probably, looking back, did not have the number of troops we needed that could have kept control of the situation, and the terrorists were out to foment the war. So it wasn't like we had a level playing field. We had people who were going to take advantage of 500-year-old hatreds between people and light a fuse to it. We eventually were able to get it under control, and then with a precipitous withdrawal, we lost that control. But I think if we'd had more troops, we probably could have at least made it so it never reached the crescendo it got to.
A moment ago, I mentioned Lord Mountbatten. He served alongside a name I did not know until I read Call Sign Chaos, Field Marshal Slim. You quote him a lot, and I'm going to turn to your reading advice now, but would you first tell people about Field Marshal Slim and what kind of impact he had on you?
Yeah, Slim was a British general early in World War II, so he got promoted and sent to a place called the China-Burma-India Theater, and many people refer to it as the Forgotten Theater after the war because they never had enough troops, enough ships, enough airplanes. He always got second-rate troops sent to him, this sort of thing. And what his book is called Defeat into Victory, I think is the title of it. But basically, again, a man who simply dealt with the cards that were dealt him. He moved against the Japanese. He was able to bring his troops together, and they were from a dozen different countries. It was like today, a combined task force sort of thing. But he was a guy who could always create options. He never said, there's nothing I can do. I just got to sit here and keep doing the same thing as before. He was always looking for different ways to fight them. And eventually was able to take what was a very resounding defeat for the Allies in World War II early in the war, turning it into a victory. Had a very close bond with his troops.
In Call Sign Chaos, there's a list of 62 books at the back that General Mattis recommends. I'm a pretty good reader. I've read less than a third of them, and so I'm humbled by this. But I was encouraged by your admonition to every reader not to read is idiotic, and more importantly, it is unethical. Now, would you unpack that, especially for the young men and women in uniform why it is unethical not to read.
Well, when I joined the Marines, I found that they were very, very disciplined and very unregimented in their thinking. The surest way to be laughed out of an operations brief was to say something wasn't doctrinal. If that was your only reason not to do it, that you literally, your subordinates wouldn't even tolerate it. They'd hear you, and they'd immediately start firing questions at you. In other words, doctrine was not a straitjacket. You should follow doctrine. It's written in blood. It's things we've learned the hard way. But do not allow that to become a straitjacket where all you can think is whatever's in the book. What they require you to do each time you get promoted, like when you go from private first class and lance corporal up to corporal, you get a list of books you've got to read. All Marines, when they come in, have to read some, lieutenants and privates. Then, you know, you finally make staff sergeant or you make captain, here's a new list of books. It goes on, even generals. You make general, you're pretty proud of yourself, come home, look in the mirror, see little stars up there, and somebody reaches to the door and says, here's your new list of books there, smart guy. So you go back to reading again. But when you're in a position in the military where when you write an order to say, here's what we're going to do, you have got to know what you're doing because people are going to put their lives on the line. And this stuck with me, Hugh, all the way through Secretary of Defense. In fact, as Secretary of Defense, there wasn't a list of books, so I gave myself a list of books to read at that level. But I wrote out a question for myself at my stand-up desk where about twice a week I would sign all the deployment orders. Remember, civilian control of our military means we never deploy one troop overseas unless a civilian signs the order. Not one troop, not one airplane, not one ship. So a couple times a week, you're, of course, with worldwide ops, you're signing these. I wrote out a question to myself that says, will this deployment of these troops contribute sufficiently to the well-being of the American people to justify them dying? Not justify them being in harm's way or justify them possibly getting injured or killed, but dying. And I hope that as I looked at the orders that came through, all those books I read had prepared me to answer those questions affirmatively.
You said, and this is a hard thing to say, if you have not read hundreds of books, you are functionally illiterate. Do you really mean that? Because that puts a huge burden on all these young men and women out there. Hundreds of books.
Well, I'll give you 40 years of service to get them done.
Okay.
So no problem. Just take it one bite at a time.
All right. I want to talk about surprise. And it's you were surprised a few times in this book by what happened. You didn't mention the Yom Kippur War much. It's occasionally mentioned there. It's Nixon's most important moment at the Nixon Library. He saves Israel. But Israel was strategically and tactically surprised, a country that is known for Overwatch. Is surprise still possible in this era with eyes ear everywhere watching everything?
Oh, absolutely surprise is possible. Let me give you an example. 9/11. I'll give you another example. How many of you knew that Sunday when you saw President Obama come on TV one night and say, we killed Osama bin Laden? That operation had been months in planning, preparation, ships positioned, troops moved around, spies doing things. I think we were successful in keeping that secret as hundreds of us knew about it. Matter of fact, the night before, as the ships were turning to go into position, as the troops were being deployed to the advanced bases to be ready to go into Pakistan, that night was the night of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And you're sitting in Washington, D.C. with 800 correspondents all sitting there, and we're all wearing our fancy clothes and everything, and people were in there having a good time. And here we were probably no more than about four of us in that room. You're kind of expected to show up and be nice to one another. There were probably four of us in that room that knew everything that was going on, and not one of those correspondents knew a thing about it. That's not irresponsible. That's not us not, you know, keeping the press informed. We owe confidentiality on military operations. That's the way you protect this country, and we're able to do it. So, yeah, we can do that. There's a lot of other things going on, too. I'll just sit up here and smile about, okay, but it's helping you to sleep safely at night.
I'm not a fan of long questions. This is my longest question, General. I made a list during reading Call Sign Chaos of the information war episodes in it. WikiLeaks did not involve sending a bullet from any gun, but it killed a lot of Americans. The enemy propaganda machine inside of Fallujah definitely impacted that battle, in your view. The pictures from Abu Ghraib was a decisive strategic defeat for America in the world. We also did not publicize the Iranian plot to blow up Cafe Milano, which you write about at length. Those are four episodes in the information war where we were beaten. Do we think enough time? You said if you're a strategist, your head should hurt from thinking about it. Do we think enough about the information war?
Well, again, ladies and gentlemen, what Hugh, you're talking about to us is where we could have done better, or decisions were made on priorities, frankly, like on the Iranian case. And I think the important thing is, if you read enough history and you live in the history of the moment, you realize what options they had and what they did about it. It leads you to ask questions. It will not show you the way, but it'll lead you to ask the right questions. And in each of these cases, had we asked the right question, we would not have been in that position, except for Abu Ghraib. And Abu Ghraib, what happened at the prison was a violation of trust. It was a commander who did not have the force of personality or the internal experience to know how you deal with a situation that was as difficult as she was dealing with. And I think it just that one is just when the system breaks down, our personnel system breaks down. But once in a while, that happens. And that's when NCOs should step forward, junior officers, and strengthen it. In the rest of them, it was history that we hadn't asked, caused us not to ask the right question. If they'd been more historically informed, I think they would have asked them.
On this stage, Secretary, I had Secretary Rumsfeld, you're the second SecDef that I've gotten to talk to on this stage, about did he see the impact of social media coming on 9/11? And he said, no, I didn't have the time, I was fighting a war. Didn't you, during your tenure in the Marines, spend time wondering about the impact of these new instruments of information warfare? Mm-hmm.
We spend a lot of time on it. We have to be careful having the military starting to take over this aspect of warfare, but we've got to be engaged in it. For example, we track social media. We use it a lot in our intelligence collection. We use social media as we try to diffuse lies put out about America. We have young guys and gals. Many of them, by the way, are from immigrant families because they know the culture, they know the language, and they know how to go back and really stand up for us and fight it out in the information space. But I think, too, that we have to look at, in the long run, we are probably culturally more capable than anyone because of freedom in order to fight, that would allow us to fight in the information space. We just have to choose to do it, then we must organize to do it. Because if we don't organize, if you have bad processes for information warfare, the same thing happens everywhere. Mix bad processes with good people, the bad processes dominate 9 out of 10 times. They suffocate initiative. Processes are complex, especially when it's a free country that does not want to be using lies like our enemy is. So you've got to stay true to your values, but you shouldn't commit suicide and not do anything, not fight in the information space. You've got to fight.
Justice Gorsuch sat in your chair on Wednesday night, 2 nights ago, to preach the values of civility and of learning civics. I don't see a lot of civility in the media. I don't see a lot of civility in social media and the exchanges between even members of families and friends. What's your assessment of the danger of the decline of civility and the ignorance of civics?
In 1858, Abraham Lincoln wasn't president yet. He was addressing the Young Men's Lyceum in Illinois. And I was reading it just because I like reading old stuff because I get new ideas. And in it he says that even all the army, combined armies, I'm paraphrasing now, of Europe and Asia and Africa, even if they had a Bonaparte, Napoleon having just died, military genius a few decades before, all combined, they could not cross the Atlantic and cross the Blue Ridge Mountains and take a mouthful of water out of the Ohio River because free men and women just wouldn't let them. It wouldn't happen. He said, if this is to die, this experiment that you and I call America, it's going to die by suicide. Very interesting. 1858, and he's already recognized if we go tribal, if we start attacking one another, that is how we die. So I think what's happened, though, Hugh, is we are now if we were running against each other for office, I'd say, I'm smart, you're not as smart. And you'd say, you're right, and I'm wrong. And sometimes it's not even civil. And I'm okay with that in an election because you're trying to divide people and say, vote for me, I want to get in office, I think I have a better idea. And I understand, it's not always civil, but welcome to democracy, raucous, it happens. I'm okay. But once you start governing, then you've got to unite. You cannot divide and govern. You have to unite to govern. The right-wing Senator Vandenberg from Michigan in the late 1940s was asked, why would you ever work with that terrible Democrat, President Truman, about a defense issue? He said, because politics stops at the water's edge. You've got to work together. You know, he too saw what Abraham Lincoln saw. We're going to have to come back together with a fundamental friendliness. We can be hard on the issues. We can yell at each other and hammer the table and everything else about the issue. But then let's go out to dinner after that or go get an adult beverage somewhere and find out how you're doing on getting your daughter into college. How's your son doing in his football game? How's his team doing? Let's get back to understanding each other and not classifying people as enemies of the state or something else just because they got a different idea about America. And if we don't get back to that, Abraham Lincoln's concern, I think, is going to manifest.
Now, General, you deal with two professions in the book, journalists and lawyers. I'm both. They don't come off so well in the book. But you are, not all journalists are as good as Bing West. You are helped along in this book by Bing West. He's an amazing writer. But you're very kind to journalists. You say that you just expect from them the ethics that you expect from your men. I'm here as a representative of the Fifth Estate to tell you that it's not going to happen. It's not an ethical group of people. The craft has been declined. You even brought up the dismissal of Stanley McChrystal, and I read with some interest that you didn't fault the president for relieving him because his officers hadn't acted right, but it was Rolling Stone that screwed him. It was a reporter who broke the rules of engagement. So how do you trust a media that wants a story more than they want to live ethically?
Well, the media is a pretty amorphous thing. It's hard to put, you know, is a social, one of these guys on social media a reporter or not? Is Rolling Stone part of the respected press? Here's my point about the press. They're not always right. They're not always fair or accurate. But they don't have to be right or accurate to do most of their duty to the country, to keep people in power on their toes, to open windows into things. Now, we have to be wise enough to know when they don't get it right, don't overreact to it, and immediately embrace it and say, aha, this is why I hate my neighbor, because look what this guy just wrote. You know, we've got to be critical. But we were always very proud, for example, for the last couple of years in the Pentagon, because we thought we had the best press corps in Washington, D.C., and they knew what they're talking about. They knew the issues. They had long-term. They had people there assigned to the Pentagon for 5, 10, 15 years. These were not sophomores when they came in and asked me questions. I got a lot of good ideas from them, frankly. So remember, the press, to carry out their constitutionally privileged duty to our country, they don't have to be right and they don't have to be fair. And a lot of people get angry at them because they're not right or fair. You know, I'll give you an example. Barbara Starr ran something on me, and she was actually fair. She took 9 seconds out of a 90-minute speech at one point where I'd glanced across a room in San Diego to some Marines who were getting ready to deploy and come down to hear me talk. I was a 3-star. And I said, sometimes it's just fun to, you know, shoot people, okay? And I was saying it because I know the enemy reads our press. And I knew that those young men, many of whom had just come back from deployment, were going right back in within weeks because we were having to rotate quickly. Well, it made the news. And I wouldn't have used those words had I known the press was in the room. I'd been told there were no TVs. So a couple months later, you know, got all over, you know, the news and people wanted me fired and the commandant had to chew me out and everything. No big deal. Like every time I got in trouble, the Marine Corps promoted me, you know? So anyone who says the Marine Corps is a no mistakes or risk averse, tell them to quit sucking their thumb, get out there and do whatever you want, do the right thing, don't be, you know, dumb about it. As long as you're not making mistakes for your own self-interest, they'll promote you. So a couple weeks later, I'm in the Pentagon, I'm walking down, and there's Barbara Starr, who had me on CNN every 15 minutes, you know? I said, Barbara, you know, what's going on? She said, old gentleman, don't beat me up. I said, I'm not, Barbara, you're just putting food on a plate for your family, but God, I mean, every 15 minutes, I'm a bachelor. I thought maybe you had something going, you know? Maybe, you know, now you don't write, you don't send flowers, you know? And she said, well, General Mattis, she said, you know, a lot of people were upset with what you said. She said, even in this building, the Pentagon. I said, well, no kidding. There's toy soldiers in this building. Wouldn't know a line of departure if they tripped over one, you know? But my point is, she's not some ogre. She's a friend of mine to this day. I respect her to this day. Let's not allow the press, when they're doing their constitutional duty, the people who wrote that constitution were smart. They knew they would screw it up once in a while. And they're willing to have them screw it up a lot, if necessary, so that never does this look like China or Russia. You know what I mean? So we should be proud every time we get angry at what they write. Say, that's my country, by golly. That darn fool can write anything, you know? But don't, you know.
From my point of view, that is correct, absolutely. There is a downside for the military, though. General Petraeus came on my show once. It became a controversy. It ended up General Betrayus in the New York Times. General Abizaid came on once. It became a controversy. This is the first time I've ever interviewed you. You're harder to track than anyone in the woods to get down to do an interview. I think the military has become risk-averse primarily about the media, thus this not using a weapon that they could use with communication. How do you change that culture in the military? Because communication is everything with civilians.
Well, I think that's a fair assessment. But I think, too, that we live at a time when the corrosive political discourse right now means that anything you say, it can be basically taken in the opposite way you meant. In other words, you could actually be eroding support for the military. What is the highest rated institution in our country in the Pew polls year after year? It's the military. Why? Because it stays out of politics. It studiously stays out. I was condemned for not getting more political at times. But my predecessor, under President Obama, he too refused to make political statements. Secretary Carter refused to do it. So I think what we have to do, I mean, I thought at times, if I said six and the president said a half a dozen, I'd immediately be attacked in the media. Aha, tension between the Pentagon and the White House, you know? So we get gun-shy of going out there, and I think that's a fair statement, but we're also in a particularly corrosive time in our country where we're hurting people's reputations. Instead of being hard on the issues, we're hard on each other, and I think we have to reverse that. Be hard on the issues. There's no need to be hard on each other.
President Nixon had a rule that he would only do interviews in his retirement if they were broadcast live and from end to end. He'd give you an hour. He sat down with an hour. He had to broadcast an hour. Is that good advice to the military to insist on rules of engagement with the press that make sure everything they said is in context?
It would be helpful, but I've been surprised how things I've said were taken out of context or things I never said were attributed to me. So I think it's mostly right now, you've got to engage. You can't expect perfection, but don't get all bent out of shape about it. So when you read, Hugh, we're working together on something, and I read Hugh Hewitt says, Mattis is a dummy. First of all, call you and say, did you say it? Don't accept it. And then go out and we have a good argument about it, if you said it, you know, that sort of thing. But I would say that it's going to take a lot more humanity and a lot less reactiveness to what you see in the press if you're going to allow for more engagement like that.
Let's go back to your career. You took over Central Command, one of the combatant commands, probably the busiest one over the last 20 years since we've been at war. You had great combatant commanders in Afghanistan and Iraq. You didn't have to worry about that much, but you said you filled your rucksack with options for Iran. Why?
Well, Iran was clearly going into dangerous territory. Iran, there were five threats. One was the nuclear weapons program, which they had used denial and deceit to say they weren't doing it. We knew they were working on it. Then, of course, there's the maritime threat, the ballistic missile threat, the cyber threat, and the big one was the terrorism. And what they were doing was destabilizing across the entire region the governments out there that so much depended on if we were going to try to make progress toward a more peaceful region, a more prosperous region. Eventually, they even tried to kill an ambassador less than 2 miles from the White House. And but for one fundamental mistake, they probably would have pulled it off by a car bomb or truck bomb in crowded Georgetown outside a restaurant. We would be having a very different conversation about Iran right now if they'd pulled that off. So my concern was that we were not dealing with Iran in a way that would temper what was going on. And remember, our problem is not with the Iranian people, and you need to keep that foremost in your mind. It is with a regime that persecutes its own people, that does not look out for their best interests, and don't allow a dislike of this autocratic, this theocratic dictatorship, really, is what it is. Don't allow that to permeate your thinking about the Iranian people. They're altogether different from these guys, these jerks in charge, and what they're doing in Bahrain right now, tonight, in Syria to keep Assad in power, a murderer, what they're doing down in Yemen to keep probably fuel a war that's creating the worst, not probably, they are fueling a war that's creating the worst humanitarian situation in the world right now is in Yemen. This is all going on with a state sponsor of terrorism at this point. And they need to be collared, and they need to be brought down to heel because they are going to really screw something up one of these days. They're going to turn off all the lights with their cyber attacks in Paris or New York, or they're going to put mines out there and run the price of oil up double what it is now, something like this. So I think it's much better we deal with these things at an immediate level rather than letting them fester. I'll give you an example. Winston Churchill was asked during World War II what to call that war. Remember, they were calling World War I the Great War in those days. And World War II was just the war that was going on. He immediately responded to the newsman who asked him, "It's the unnecessary war." Now think about that. Tens of millions, 50, 60, we don't even know how many tens of millions died in that war. Everything that came out of that, the unnecessary war. He said if the democracies had gotten together and worked issues like Hitler and Mussolini in the 30s, they were so weak, it never had to go to a war. It did not have to go that way. And so let's just make sure we do what we can to prevent war now and we don't follow the bad lessons of history.
One of the books you reference in your appendix is The Peace to End All Wars, the history of the Middle East after World War I. Mm-hmm. When Churchill and all the Arab specialists came in from England and they drew lines on a map and it was supposed to settle things forever, do you think that peace in that region is actually possible given the historic confrontation of Persia with the Arab regimes and now with the introduction of Israel into the land?
I'm a glass half full kind of guy, Hugh. I think peace is possible. We're going to have international help to do it, I think is the point you draw from what you just described. It's going to take other nations rewarding the right kind of behavior. There are good people out there, strategic thinkers out there. The King of Jordan is a classic example. Mohammed bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of United Arab Emirates. We call United Arab Emirates and the U.S. military little Sparta because every time we get into a jam, the Emirates are with us. Their troops are fighting right alongside with us, for example, tonight in Afghanistan. So there are people out there that we can build out from, but it's going to take it's going to take a coalition of nations that are not adding fuel to the fire in order to stop Iran, what they're doing, to give them the tools on counterterrorism that are going to be needed.
You write in one line, I won't forget, history is compelling, nations with allies thrive, nations without allies wither. Mm-hmm. Does Israel have real allies in the region beside us?
Israel has nations in the region, Arab nations in the region, with common interests and common perspectives. Yes.
All right. That's well put. Let me ask you about General Soleimani. Not many people know his name. Sometimes people surprisingly don't know his name. What do you make of him as a tactician and a strategist?
Soleimani is crafty, murderous, and willing to do anything to kill Jews, destabilize the region, promote anti-Americanism. He's very committed.
You studied the six Iraqi generals that you had to jump off at in 2003. Is Soleimani better than the average general, much better than the average general, or just another general?
What he was referring to, before we went into the attack into Iraq, there were six Iraqi army divisions in the area that my Marine division would fight. And I had first lieutenants or some captains. Each of them were assigned one of those generals to tell me all about them. So I knew where they'd gone to school, how many kids they had, where their families lived. In other words, were they subject to Saddam Hussein killing or torturing them if they didn't do what they're told, things like that. So I know those six well. I've obviously studied Soleimani. Soleimani's better than any of them.
Well noted. We're running low on time, so I have to skip on my outline. You talked about the danger of the aura of omniscience existing in the civilian leadership of the Pentagon. Would you explain what that is, and how do we combat that danger?
The aura of
omniscience. That everybody at 1600 knows what's going on.
So it goes back to the earlier point, I think, Hugh, about what we have today with this instant communication. You can start feeling like you really know better than the guys and gals out there in the field. You can start thinking you know everything that they're doing. You don't realize that there's going to be opportunities that they spot if they, excuse me, if they know what you want done, they can take advantage of. You can start thinking that you're omniscient. You really know it all. And it's much better to have good feedback loops and displays of data so that you know what's happening on the front lines, and make sure you stay in your own area. Like, if your job is strategy, don't go down and start telling people how to fight in a city. Stay up on strategy. If you don't like the guys you're fighting in the city, change the commander. Get him out. If you don't trust him, don't have confidence in him. But don't start muddying the waters, because when you stop looking at what you're doing to do someone else's job, guess what's falling apart? The important stuff up here. That omniscience can be very, very corrosive to accuracy.
There are a lot of Metternichs on MSNBC, my network. They're not really Metternichs, but they talk like they are. What is your opinion of, they're not even chateau generals, which you referred to. They're civilians like me who have never been close to hearing a shot fired in anger. What do you think when they opine on this?
Well, you know, first of all, I admire anyone who's at least interested enough to study it a little bit. I hope they study it. But at the same time, you've got to be careful who you listen to. Most of us would not go to a carpenter if we had needed brain surgery. You know, it's just, I mean, they may have a Black & Decker variable speed drill, but you really don't want that, you know. I think what you want to do is just make sure that you have people who have more than a gravelly voice speaking authoritatively, giving advice. And that's up to the networks again. But eventually the networks will, they get some pretty good people on there too, I've noticed, you know. Often. Once in a while, they get some ones who don't know a thing, don't have a clue what they're doing. But, you know,
let me ask you,
even dumb people need employment sometimes.
We have a lot of it. Let me ask you about the impact of erasing the red line. You write about it in the book. It has long-term consequences, which I think every American president going forward should study. What happens when we threaten to do something and we don't do it?
Well, when you're handed your rifle, as I was in 1969 in the Marine Corps, had a corporal say something to me that a lot of other Marines have heard, and he said, "This is the only reason you exist from now on is this rifle. Don't ever point it at anyone unless you intend to pull the trigger. No screwing around with this thing." I think when you set a red line and you don't live up to it, then the moral authority is eroded. And I'll give you a classic example. After the red line that was drawn by a previous administration about chemical weapons in Syria, I and we didn't hit them for the use of chemical weapons that year. I got a phone call from a foreign diplomat, retired diplomat, who I'd been when I was a second lieutenant. I'd gotten to know him. He was a second lieutenant in his army out in the Western Pacific. And we know each other very well, so it's a very familiar sort of communication. And I saw his number come up on my personal cell phone, so I grabbed it. And he said, "Well, Jim, it looks like we're on our own with China." 36 hours after we failed to carry out our red line in Syria, in the Pacific, a guy who had served in their military as a young officer, joined the diplomatic corps, had served as ambassador in two different countries, a very seasoned diplomat, good man. And that's the lesson he drew from us not carrying out the red line that we drew against chemical weapons convention violation.
General, I want to end with three lessons applicable to military and civilian from your book, call sign Chaos. What do I know? Who needs to know it? Have I told them? I think I read that 20 times in the book. What does that mean for this audience?
Well, the bottom line is somewhere, for example, when I commanded a 23,000-man division, somewhere in that division was everything I needed to know. Do you have ways of getting from the youngest sailors and Marines in the division up to you what you need to know? Not everything, just what you need to know. The only way to do that is to create an atmosphere where everybody feels like they own the mission. You give them very clear guidance, then you take your hands off the steering wheel, you circulate around and you watch them, you coach them, you coach them, and you coach them. But they have to be thinking all the time, what do I know? Who needs to know if I told them? Because when they see the opportunity, they need to fire that up to you so you can turn a whole lot of support from them. You may say, this is what we're doing over here, and all of a sudden they see the opportunity here, and you're going to shift everything. Give you an example. We had an Army J-STARS downlink station in my headquarters in the Marine Division. And we had a real problem going through the land between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates. That was the area given to my division to attack on Baghdad and keep the 3rd Infantry Division on the left, the U.S. Army Division, moving. And we couldn't find a place, a road to go. And one night we were sitting there, and the J-STARS private in the Army, he had a rather colorful time, his sergeant told me, in his career to date, a private in the Army who was watching the screen, he said, you know, there might be another route over here because this guy's going really fast up this unfinished roadway. So we all walk over and look at it in the tent. I said, how fast is he going? He puts his cursor on him, and he puts it on him again a little bit later. He said, 68 kilometers an hour. And immediately, every colonel's head in the CP turned toward me, looking, and I said, swing 15,000 Marines up that roadway. Now, 23,000 Marines in division, 15,000 switched right there, because one young man overhearing what was going on said, you might want to look at something here. So that's how you make decisions in the real world. It's not done the way it's done on TV, you know, or you have all these old people sitting around and hammering a table and stuff. Now, it's some young man with a rather colorful first tour in the Army spotting something like that.
Okay, applicable to every single person in this room. You write, everyone needs a mentor or to be a mentor. Why and how important is it in the military vis-a-vis the civilian world?
I'd only add that nobody needs a tyrant in the midst of that. You know, I learned a lot from my mentors. Let me give you three. A second lieutenant in the infantry, got 40 sailors and Marines, and my first platoon sergeant, it was right after Vietnam. We didn't have enough senior NCOs to go around, what we call E6s and above. And so my first platoon sergeant, instead of being a staff sergeant, E6, was Corporal Wayne Johnson, a British East Indies immigrant to America. Of course, with a name like that, we immediately christened him John Wayne. And we were on our way. And what he taught me, this 22-year-old corporal, was what a lieutenant should be interested in and doing, and even better, what a lieutenant should never hear, even if he hears it. Just leave these things to NCOs. 22 years old, corporal, filling a job that should have been filled by a 27, 30-year-old staff sergeant. My next platoon sergeant was Corporal Manuel Rivera, immigrant from Mexico. And Corporal Rivera was as authoritarian as you could imagine, and yet he had a way, because he is so physically strong, of just helping Marines anytime on a march or in a difficult thing, that they just naturally gravitated to him. I saw the power of a force of personality. Never raised his voice, didn't have to. Finally, I got a staff sergeant, Remy Lebrun. Yep, French-Canadian, right out of Quebec. Had a funny accent and everything. But he would show how he could use a sense of humor with the troops on the worst day to keep them going. And I saw what not just trust and respect, but what affection did to a unit. And I learned a lot. Those were my first three real mentors in the Marine Corps. Not one of them outranked me. They were all junior. Mentors come in all shapes and sizes, but we all need mental models for what works. And then we adopt things. We don't become them. We got to do it in our own unique way. But another thing is, we don't need tyrants. You know, that's not a way to run any organization, or abusiveness. I got over and joined public humiliation by second grade, you know? So what you want to do is bring out the best in people. That's what I wrote the book for, frankly.
And it succeeds. I can't emphasize enough. I think it's an instant classic. Let me close with an out-of-the-box question. You're a student of military history. The great commanders are Alexander, Caesar, and Napoleon. If they looked at your United States Marine Corps, what would they see? Obviously, air power would be new and artillery, but what would they see, not artillery, that is the same of the wars that they fought, and what would they marvel at in the Marine Corps?
Well, what they'd find the same is that for those who go into the close quarters, the intimate fighting, it's the spirit that matters more than the weapons or the equipment, what they're wearing. It's the fighting spirit, and in that regard, they would stand in awe of the U.S. Marine Corps.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking General Mattis.
Thanks, Hugh. Thanks very much, Hugh. I just enjoy the way you do things.
I like doing interviews. I could talk to you for 3 hours. Time for a pause now in this edition of the interview with Hugh Hewitt. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Now back to this edition of Hugh Hewitt and the interview. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Good morning to you all. 2 weeks ago tomorrow, I had the honor of sitting down with General James Mattis, former Secretary of Defense, of course, Marine Corps General, at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda. It was a terrific conversation. It was too short. It was only an hour and 15 minutes, and General Mattis has done me the great kindness of allowing me to continue it this morning. General, welcome. Congratulations. Call sign Chaos. Your new book is a New York Times bestseller. Congratulations.
Well, thanks, Hugh, and it's good to be on your show.
It is good to have you back. After that conversation, my brother-in-law, a Vietnam-era Marine, said, did you ask him about General Tulin, a buddy of his from long ago? I said, I didn't, but I think General Tulin is the fellow who came up with call sign Chaos, right?
He is the irreverent junior that came up with my call sign. That's correct.
Can you give people the story behind it? Because it's a great way to begin the conversation about the serious stuff.
Well, John and I were serving out in the Mojave Desert with about 7,000 sailors and Marines in our regiment. He was my operations officer, and I would constantly go down to his office because I had brilliant ideas. He would listen patiently, and then sometimes they would actually work. But one day I was down giving him another one of my brilliant suggestions, and as I was walking up his office, I saw chaos written on his whiteboard. I asked him what that was about, and he avoided the question, so then I got very interested, got it out of him, worked it out of him. It was, Colonel has another outstanding suggestion. It was a somewhat tongue-in-cheek view of the level of brilliance he thought I had compared to what I thought I had. But I thought it was a good reminder to stay humble in this world, so I adopted it as my call sign.
Another episode in Call Sign Chaos is when you're meeting with troops, I believe it's before the first Iraq war, and they're saying, we're living the dream, sir, we're fine. And you said, no, come on, tell me the truth. Give me something I can fix. I think that's great advice to every leader. Did the Marines respond then? And I know they did then, but do they often respond to give me something I can fix as a great invitation to get real feedback?
Well, like all my good ideas, I adopted that from someone else. I was reading about a mayor of New York who, as he wandered around the city, always asked, how am I doing? Knowing that in the military hierarchy, few people really want to be critical of a general, I adapted it and I said, give me something I can fix. And that would often elicit a response. They'd be some of the most mundane things. To needing toilet paper in the latrines and the heads, to something much more significant that we're not really sure what we're supposed to do here, at which time all my senses went on high alert, knowing that if your troops don't know what you want, they're probably not going to deliver it. So, yes, it did work, and it continues to work to this day, and I think it works in any leadership position.
Now, General, one of the things I liked about Call Sign Chaos is you do not minimize the difficulty of combat. And I don't mean the threat of combat. I mean the crude living, the difficult hours, the no showers, no shaving, keep moving, dust in your eyes, dust everywhere for weeks at a time. I think Bing West and you really tried to communicate what it was like to march up to Baghdad or the first time in the Gulf War, destroy the Republican Guard.
Well, you know, Bing is a very combat-seasoned Marine. He was a wonderful writer to co-author the book with, and he was the one who showed me how you put it in human terms, how you try to take the reader and move them into the actual complexities, the discomfort, the danger, and yet also reveal the character of those who go in, that just this unselfish commitment to one another that really keeps young men going when they're in the face of the enemy. So I learned a lot about writing in putting this book together, but it also recalled to me why I stuck around that outfit for four decades, and that was just the absolute joy of serving alongside young patriots who signed that blank check payable with their lives to the American people. And they just stay rambunctious and high-spirited in the face of no showers for 2 months or the danger of walking in mine-strewn roadways, that sort of thing. They're just a joy to be around.
General, you also take time, and this touched my brother-in-law, George Philip, to talk about Vietnam veterans. You are not yourself a Vietnam-era veteran. You came in after the war had been over. But you spend a lot of time talking about the lessons they imparted to you, the role that they played in the forming of the modern Corps, and the debt we owe them. I'd like you to expand on that, because they don't often hear that from people.
Well, I can't say it too often. These were the sergeants, the gunnery sergeants, the captains, the majors, who, when I joined the Marine Corps, they imparted to me the grim skills that I would need. They were unrelenting in their demands, but they were coaches. They weren't tyrants. They didn't lord it over those of us who hadn't been in Vietnam. Rather, they tried to share what they knew. And they constantly brought out the demands that would be placed on you and how you deal with those, from the youngest NCOs who'd been in Vietnam, who have a lot to do with a young infantry officer's success, if you listen to them, to the very, very senior officers for whom Vietnam was not their only war. These guys put their thumbprint on us, and they did it in a way, at a time, and in a manner that really changed the way you looked at combat, at war, and I would like to think that listening to them carefully, we brought more people home alive from the wars we then had to fight because they had warned us what we were in for.
I think another person who probably got that lesson, and he is very well presented in Call Sign Chaos, is General Dunford. Now, we have a friend in common in Mel Spee, so I had met General Dunford at the military YMCA fundraiser, and I got the sense of presence that he communicates. But in Call Sign Chaos,
He seems like the steadiest guy on a battlefield you could possibly want.
Well, nothing could unsettle the guy we called Fighting Joe Dunford. No braggadocio. He is simply a man who does the job, but he also earns and earns over and over again every day the confidence of his subordinates, the confidence of his seniors. He was someone who wasted no time on unproductive discussions. Matter of fact, he would recognize when a tough decision was made that had to be carried out, and he rolled up his sleeves and carried it out. But he had a way of connecting with the youngest sailors and Marines on the battlefield, and when he was in personal danger, his voice wouldn't even change on the radio. It was still the calm, steady as she goes, Joe Dunford, in command of himself and rapidly in command of any situation that was thrown in his lap.
He also turns out to be a very competent diplomat. I was on a trip with John Bolton when he was there to talk with our Turkish counterparts, and I've seen him do that a time and time again. Allies are in the news. Allies are a lot in call sign chaos. I want to quote the book, "History is compelling. Nations with allies thrive. Nations without them wither." Yesterday, our allies, specifically Great Britain, France, and Germany, finally came around to our point of view about the Iranians, insisting that the Iranians come back to the table prepared to get rid of the sunset on the JCPOA, to get rid of their intercontinental ballistic missiles, to stop their bad export of terror. I'm welcoming this development. Didn't get much attention yesterday, but I think you would as well, because you're a big proponent of allies working in concert.
Well, I've had the opportunity, the privilege even, of fighting many times for our country, Hugh, and I have never fought in an all-American formation. For example, we set up NATO to defend Western Europe. That was the whole point of it after World War II, when the Russians clearly were no longer going to be our allies. In fact, the first time NATO went to war, declared Article 5 that an attack on one was an attack on all, was when New York City and Washington, D.C. were attacked on 9/11. And immediately, I was in Afghanistan within 2 months, and I was joined on the battlefield by allies, by Canadian troops and Norwegian, Australian, New Zealand, United Kingdom, Germany, Jordan, Turkey. Not all of them were NATO allies, but because NATO was there, that attracted other allies. And I think that, as they say down under in Australia, you never have enough mates, you never have enough friends, or you never have enough allies. And America's unique strength is the number of nations that see our values as a reason to align with us. We're not an empire of geography where we take over other countries. We're an empire of ideas, and when we stay true to our values, that's when we have our like-minded nations with us. And you just pointed out here on Iran, which has been a very, very difficult issue, including for our allies. And yet, like you pointed out, they aligned with us yesterday in a way. Didn't make a lot of news because of some other things going on, but that was a key development. You're right.
You write a lot about Iran in Call Sign Chaos, General, if I can pause on that. You said it sent command. You had great commanders on the field in Iraq and Afghanistan, so it was your job to come up with a knapsack full of options for dealing with Iran. I'm sure they've been updated. I'm sure they're still there. Do you think our allies, or at least your colleagues in uniform, have the same understanding of the threat posed by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps that you do?
I have no doubt that the military is alert to that danger on a strategic level. You can't be completely focused there because we have other interests around the world. But certainly what you do in the military is you come up with military options and you align with the State Department and our diplomats who are the front line on our foreign policy and make certain our diplomats always speak from a position of strength. But at the same time, most of the problems in the world are not dealt with by military options. And you see this administration working the options of sanctions right now and aligning diplomats for diplomatic action to deal with the Iranian, the absolutely inexcusable Iranian attacks on countries and shipping in the region. But at the same time, there are a lot of other options besides the military options that you want to exhaust first. But the military owes options to the commander-in-chief, and I have no doubt those options have been worked up.
In Call Sign Chaos, you refer to the United Arab Emirates as, quote, Little Sparta. And I've heard that term thrown around. If you can explain why. And then they have a nuclear power complex, which is the only one in that region. It worries me, given the attack on Saudi Arabia's oil facility. Do you think UAE, Little Sparta, can defend its own there?
Well, Little Sparta got its reputation because every time we were in trouble, they would be fighting alongside us. I still remember them in Desert Storm. I remember them in Bosnia when we were working there, and actually we had some challenges getting allies with us. But United Arab Emirates was with us 100%. They are in Afghanistan with us today. This is a nation that has troops that are professional. They know how to fight. And I think that they're a nation that we have got to keep with us. Now, in terms of the nuclear enterprise they have there, and by the way, it's one they invite in the International Atomic Energy folks to keep an eye on. They have no secrets about it. It is a peaceful program, uniquely different than the way Iran has treated the inspectors over many years. Basically, United Arab Emirates has got a responsible approach to this. Now, can they protect what they have for a nuclear industry against any kind of attack? I'm confident that they can. However, that does not mean that Iran should be given a free hand to practice more of this inexcusable activity. The whole world has got to tell Iran to stop this. We need a stable Middle East if we're ever to stop the killing and the chaos that's coming out of that region, because this affects the entire world, and we cannot tolerate this continued effort by Iran from trying to murder the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago, to attacking Saudi Arabia, to attacking shipping, to shooting down our own reconnaissance aircraft. This is intolerable.
Now, I want to switch subjects on you, General Mattis, to something else in Call Sign Chaos, which I did not get to at the Nixon Library, and I kicked myself in the butt for. You killed off Joint Command because of EBO. It is a marvelous case study in having the willingness to confront the obvious malfunction of an idea gone wrong. Would you tell people that story and why the acronym EBO was a menace to the military?
Well, EBO, effects-based operations, was an approach by that command to take a valid, workable U.S. Air Force process to take on, for example, an electrical grid or a railroad grid or a highway grid. And how do you break those grids so that the enemy, the effect on the enemy, is most precise and most compelling? The problem was, at Joint Forces Command, they lost sight of the theoretical aspects. And when you don't pay attention to theory, when you don't pay attention to the fundamental nature of anything, then you're going to get in trouble when you start coming up with solutions that violate the fundamental nature, in this case of war, which is fundamentally unpredictable. You start a war, many nations do, and end up losing it. Now, they didn't start the war to lose it. It means that there's something unpredictable by its nature. And so when I realized that intellectually this command was not coming up with sound ideas, we ended up paying a price that you could only see in hindsight. For example, we were still shrinking the size of the U.S. Army as this war against terrorism began, and we saw soldiers going back-to-back 15-month tours because we decided you didn't need a larger army because of these, what I would call, bumper stickers. So there came a point when Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of Joint Chiefs, were dealing with some very tough budget issues, and I realized then there was a way to do the good parts of that command and yet disband the overarching organization, which was frankly intellectually not up to the job. So I recommended it go away. The Secretary of Defense, under Admiral Mike Mullen's suggestion, who brought it to him, agreed. And for the first time since World War II, we disbanded a four-star man that was no longer fit for its purpose.
It is a terrific message to every leader of every team about getting rid of that which is no longer useful and indeed counterprotective. The other message, I've already used this in my job is running the Nixon Foundation, communicating commander's intent. You can have decentralized decision making provided you write decision makers have the commander's intent down. The aligned independence of subordinate units depends upon commander intent being communicated. Can you expand on that, General Mattis?
I can. The Vietnam veterans had put an idea in my head that the more decisions have to go up to the highest level, the more you paralyze any organization. And their point to me was make very clear, spend a lot of time as an officer communicating what you want to do in vague terms, how you want to do it, and what you want at the end as an end state. And at that point, take your hands off the steering wheel and allow your subordinates to use their initiative and their aggressiveness to carry it out. So what you want to do is create an environment where from the most senior people in an organization down, in my case, to the youngest sailors and Marines, they all feel like they own the mission, and then you want them to use their initiative. You reward them for using their initiative and carrying it out. That is the way, that is the method you do it, is by making this very clear in what we call in the military commander's intent. But again, Hugh, this is something that works in any organization where you want everybody pulling together. And that's the way you do it. You delegate the responsibility for decision-making down to the lowest competent level, and they're made, they're made competent by you training them and coaching them. And once you've trained them and coached them to a point where they can do the job, then just make sure that you don't use command and control, rather use command and feedback. So as you unleash their initiative, you're constantly hearing from them what's going on, and you know when to adjust. But you want to get as much delegation of authority as you reasonably can, because that's the way organizations move more swiftly when opportunities present themselves and they don't get caught behind the competition.
Before I switch, General, to some specific battles, I want to do one more lesson from Call Sign Chaos applicable to every organization. Quote, high morale is reflected by the absence of self-pity. Close quote. Why is that true, General Mattis?
Well, there's two points I'd make on this. First of all, if you ever see victimhood where people say, well, I'm a victim, things happened, and you know that I don't have any options. The Vietnam generation taught me loud and clear, you can always create options. But the other point is cynicism. When someone starts getting cynical and said, well, there's nothing I can do about it anyway, so why try? In the military, they taught me this is just a form of cowardice. In other words, I'm going to give up because nothing can be done about it. And the Marines taught me, and my study of philosophy reinforced, that there's only one thing in this world that we really control, and that is, what is your response to what happens around you? And you can always respond with something that will improve the situation. You can always come up with options unless you surrender to cynicism or victimhood. And I would just suggest, again, this is something that even in our country at large, we've got to get away from looking at exalting being a victim and exalt in those who actually change things for the better. And we've got a long history of these people, from our founding fathers to Abraham Lincoln to John F. Kennedy to Martin Luther King Jr. We have seen patriots step forward, and history is full of people like this who said, you know, we can do better. And that's usually done by people who don't accept the status quo, who don't accept that they're victims or that they should be cynical about the opportunities that are out there. There are opportunities. Go find them.
You also praise mavericks and believe that organizations have to protect and nurture them. Very quickly, why? And then we'll turn to the war.
Well, mavericks are those who sometimes make organizations uncomfortable. They come up with ideas that others haven't thought of. Once in a while in the military, they need a haircut. They haven't shined their shoes. And I used to tell my one stars, my rear admirals and brigadier generals, you're high enough ranking to have a lot of authority. You're still low enough ranking that you can spot these mavericks. And I want each of you to find one of them and protect him and nurture him. Get a haircut and shine your shoes, but most importantly, take their ideas and prove they won't work. Don't make them prove they will work. Make your own team prove they won't work. Assume they will work, because you may not like the Mavericks' ideas, but you're going to like it a lot less if the enemy teaches you the lesson that your Mavericks were trying to teach you.
Now, General, if I can switch to the battles that you recount in Call Sign Chaos with a context that's modern. As soon as I had finished Call Sign Chaos, which is an instant classic in my view, I read Henry Kissinger's On China for a second time, because I think they are the American competitor for the next 100, if not 200 years. Are the lessons so hard earned in the first Gulf War, in Afghanistan, in the Iraq War, and now in the War on Terror, are they applicable to the competition we are in with the People's Republic of China?
Well, they are applicable. However, every conflict, every competition, every adversary, every competitor is unique. So you can't copy them like a template. What you have to do is you have to adapt the lessons that you learned there to the specific situation. And that's why the study of history is so important to leaders, because the study of history will not, in and of itself, give you a roadmap or a plan to be copied. What history will often do is just light that dark path ahead, because there's no other way to light it, really, and tell you what questions to ask, because you'll see how other people successfully or unsuccessfully dealt with a similar situation. For example, there's a model in the 3rd century AD of how the Roman Empire dealt with challenging times, where they were having challenging fiscal times, their military was challenged, their diplomats were not respected, and they came through. There were also examples of that under the Sun King in France in the 1700s, and our own country has been through tough times from the Civil War to World War II. So you adapt these lessons learned to the specific circumstance, but there's a great deal of value to studying history, and there's a great deal of danger to ignoring history.
One of the things I studied carefully was your setup of forward operating base Rhino. The largest expeditionary force the United States has ever sent was that which you sent from Task Force 78 into the middle of Afghanistan, which has no coast, of course. And then I began to think about China. I don't know that we could ever use an expeditionary force under any circumstance against the People's Republic of China, because it is so vast, General Mattis. Am I ignoring the idea that there's always something new under the sun if you use the best from the old books?
Well, I think it was the deepest penetrating amphibious assault in history going into Afghanistan. However, what you have to do is look at the theme of what happened there. How do you penetrate? One point would be expeditionary bases alongside our allies around China would certainly complicate any kind of conflict from China's point of view. It would also strengthen our allies and let them know that we are with them. That would allow diplomats perhaps to help deter a war. We don't want to just deter a great power war. We want great power peace. And part of this is going back to your earlier question, Hugh, about allies. If you have allies, and if they are representative democracies, for example, then by their very existence nearby China, the young people in the streets of Hong Kong today are emboldened. The democracy of Taiwan is strengthened by those other examples around them. So you don't look at the amphibious invasion into Afghanistan right after 9/11 as only a military approach. There are also diplomatic approaches. There are approaches that use information warfare. The penetration may very well be just to show the Chinese people that they deserve a government that does not violate international norms, that they stand to benefit economically, culturally, as a nation, if they have a leadership that listens to the international community, that none of us can go our own way alone in this world. Globalization is not a policy. Globalization is a reality, and China has to deal with that reality as well. So I would move the military example of Afghanistan up to a higher level, perhaps, Hugh, of diplomacy and how we do economic relations, that sort of thing.
General Mattis, last week I had a conversation with a very senior retired American diplomat, whom everybody respects, who was warning that America has to be very careful not to over-encourage the Hong Kong demonstrators. Tiananmen Square is a bit of history, and President Xi is not going to allow Hong Kong to become an independent state. As you reflect on that, what's your advice to Americans talking about Hong Kong, about how we do it to both stand with that which we believe in, freedom, but not over-encourage what is essentially a defenseless force in the face of a very strong PLA massing on its border?
Yeah, well, it's a good point. This is not something that we are going to intervene in militarily. And so that's why that diplomat probably said we would not want to over-encourage. I think the number one thing we do in a situation like this is make certain our own example here in the United States shows how people govern, shows how people come to compromise, how we understand one another. And this is an area we've got our own problems with right now. But we need to show that democracy is a functioning way to govern, not just to have elections, but after we have elections, that we actually roll up our sleeves and work together to solve problems. And this is a challenge right now, and it's a challenge in France. We can see the challenge in the United Kingdom, and certainly here at home. We have got to find a way to most of all give the example of a functioning democracy that's based on respect for everyone's views, that we listen to one another, and then that we act in concert with compromise in order to carry forward the best ideas. And I think that our example is what would be most invaluable to the people in the streets of Hong Kong. We are not going to convince them not to stand up for their own freedom. They obviously have been in the streets for a while, and they've proven that they will stand up for the freedoms they believe they deserve. And remember, Hugh, this is not just an internal problem for China. Remember that back in the, I think it was in the 1980s, when China came to us for our support for the return of Hong Kong from British control, a vestige of the colonial times, to China. And they promised us at that time it would be one country but two systems. And these problems that we're seeing today, where the people are upset in Hong Kong, stem from a very ill-advised law they tried to force on Hong Kong, which was extradition. In other words, it would not have been two systems. And they gave us their word there would be one country, two systems. They gave the people of Hong Kong their word it would be two systems. And when they start to violate that, we shouldn't be surprised that the people of Hong Kong take umbrage at it and go into the streets. But at the same time, I don't think we should be half-stepping that we believe in democracy and we believe countries should live up to their word when they give it.
Now, General Mattis, staying on this theme, you write at length in Callsign Chaos about you reaping the benefits of people who planned on sea lift capacity a generation before you got your stars when you invaded Afghanistan. And right now, the new National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, is a huge proponent of President Trump's plan for a 355-ship Navy. I think one of the advantages of Callsign Chaos is you drive home 25 years from now, the next Mattis is going to be fighting with whatever we provide today. I'm not sure our Congress is that forward-looking anymore.
Well, we do seem to watch in Washington, D.C., as they're consumed by near-term and immediate issues, perhaps a real lack of nonpartisanship when we face certain challenges. But remember, last December, 87% of the House and the Senate, Republican and Democrat, voted for the highest military budget in terms of raw dollars that we've had. So I believe there is a degree of bipartisanship or nonpartisanship when it comes to defense. We are going to see a more naval or maritime strategy as our military strategy. I think this is simply a reality as we deal with the changing world. So we must watch closely the size of the U.S. Navy and make certain that our naval forces are equipped to be the lead element. Of course, we need the Army, the Air Force, the Marines there as part of a joint effort. But we will have to watch and make certain that what we're turning over is a military capable of protecting this experiment we call America 20 years from now, because we can't be in a position where we think 3.1 or 3.6%, if you include the Veterans Administration, is exorbitant in terms of defense. We can afford survival in America. We also have to make sure our allies are doing their fair share, and that's where we have a continuing effort by the Trump administration to try to take countries like Korea or Western Europe that were admittedly bombed flat in World War II or on their backs economically. They're no longer on their backs, and all the democracies have to pitch in. We can't just say the American taxpayer is going to pay this bill. All the democracies are going to have to work together for their own common defense. But I think we can afford it, and I would just say that the Congress can be persuaded if we have a good strategic argument. I wouldn't say that the fringe elements of either party can be, but certainly the bulk of the Congress can be persuaded if we have a sound strategy that makes sense to the American Congress, the American people.
Let's conclude our conversation about call sign chaos, General, by talking about the Battle of Fallujah. Specifically, you warn again and again that Washington, D.C. decision makers cannot presume to know what's going on a battlefield, no matter how refined the modern tools of communication, no matter how close it appears on the computer screen, they're not there. And the Battle of Fallujah, the first Battle of Fallujah, may be the most frustrated you are in call sign chaos. Can you explain why and how the aura of omniscience back in Washington, D.C., or in this case, Coalition Provisional Headquarters, led to what was a very bad result in the first Battle of Fallujah?
Well, what happened in Fallujah was that we had some civilian contractors who got basically into an area they shouldn't have been in. They were killed, four of them. Their bodies desecrated, burned, and hung from bridges. We knew in Fallujah that it was a tribal town, so we would be able to find members of tribes that disagreed with what had happened, disagreed vehemently. We would recover the bodies, return them to their loved ones. But we also had photographs, and we had our spies in the town who could guide us to hunt down the guys who had done it and take them out. I did not want to do a full-scale assault on the town because we were under troop caps at this time. I did not have enough troops to do it right, to seal off the town. I was ordered to go in. We had to evacuate the people. I said, okay, you know, those are the orders. I got it. I knew that my military chain of command had recommended we allow the operation to proceed as I recommended. Instead, I was ordered to go in, and I said, okay, let's get on with it. Those are the orders. They're not called likes. They're called orders. I didn't have to like it. But the bottom line was, I said, but don't stop me. Once we start into that city, don't stop me. So we got over 300,000 people out of the city. The terrorists were numerous. We were attacking in the city. And deep inside the city, due to a lot of public releases of information, some of it true, much of it untrue, by the adversary, basically, politically, we were stopped, even though I had the support two, three levels above me in the military chain of command. We were stopped deep inside the city. I was ordered to negotiate with the adversaries there, the ones who represented them anyway. They weren't the terrorists themselves. They were their minions. And then eventually I was ordered out of the city. We warned at that time we'll have to go back in. But we handed a moral victory to the enemy, who then their recruiting, their fundraising picked up, and it was a real setback. And as my troops were being withdrawn, I remember one young lad being filthy dirty, being interviewed about how terrible this was, that they'd lost their buddies. They were being forced to fall back, and they must feel terrible. And he just looks calmly into the camera, and he says, it doesn't matter. We'll hunt them down somewhere else and kill them. And that's an example of what happens when the troops keep faith with you. They knew we'd fought not to do this, and they did not take it in a way that they would lower their morale. I was amazed at how they kept faith with us. But unfortunately, Hugh, we did have to go back in months after I'd left Iraq, and we took hundreds of killed and wounded in order to take the city. And now the terrorists had had time to really prepare, to stockpile ammunition, to build bunkers inside houses. So, yes, it was a very frustrating time. And I think it's a reminder that policymakers have to set an achievable end state. And then once you make the commitment to go into a fight, you cannot stop halfway. You can't go wobbly at that point. You've got to finish it as quickly as possible on your own terms.
If you're going to take Vienna, take Vienna. You don't use the PG-13 of Napoleon in Call Sign Chaos. Very last question, General. Is my business, journalism, are we up to the task of cooperating without being compromised with military campaigns, because we're in the business of getting clicks and stories read that sometimes works to the great disadvantage of people whose lives are on the line? Do you see us reconciling that tension?
I do not. I accept that under our Constitution, the press, to do its job, does not even need to be fair or accurate. I accept that, although I think many people in the responsible press, and I find them across the political spectrum, there's representatives of responsible press, they do try to get it right. And there are some that actually have been aware of classified information and have not printed it in a manner that would cost us casualties. But the press is so amorphous now. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And what we need to do as members of the government is make certain that we're working with the responsible members, even when they're reporting something that's uncomfortable for us, and do our best to keep them close so that they get full transparency, at least to the degree we can. There are some things you simply have to classify or we'll fail. A raid to capture bin Laden. We could not announce that in advance, and nobody would have expected us to. But there are many people in the press, I think, who, if they had heard about it, would not have announced it. But there are others who, you're right, they would have. So the press manifests itself one person, one man, one woman at a time, and people should have to live with their reputations, as far as I'm concerned. And I'll do my best to always open doors to members of the press. I did so when I was on active duty. I remember with 1st Marine Division and 23,000 troops, I had over 100 members of the press embedded among them. I was that confident that what they would see would be heartening for the American people and the global audience. So it's got the good, the bad, and the ugly, just like every human organization, Hugh.
Well, the Call Sign Chaos recounts a lot of good, and I appreciate that. I appreciate the book. General Mattis, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you. Congratulations on a bestseller, and thank you for your service to the country over, well, five decades.
Hey, thanks very much, Hugh. It's good talking with you. Good luck to you.
Thank you.